I'm excited to be here. I'm probably going to move around a lot and not just laterally, but probably up and down as well. I've actually got some videos that I want to share today too. And I did bring notes. Sometimes I go without notes, but we need notes today because there's a lot that I want to cover. And I want to make sure that you guys get good value today. This verse from Genesis 15:5, I want you guys to think about it as we just kind of discuss these things together. And there might be some ones where I have certain feedback, so don't be afraid to do that. This is God bringing Abraham outside and actually telling him for the first time in the history of humanity to do science. So if I talk about silent science and what they're not going to tell you in school, I want you to know that I'm not opposed to science. God's not opposed to science. As a matter of fact, he challenges us to look up in the heavens and he says, actually, consider yourself with these things and figure them out if you can. That's almost God's challenge to us. He wants us to have that sense of awe and wonder as we look up. But let's talk about silent science today. There are many issues that we concern ourselves with, especially right now. How many people are under 18? Maybe. But we're concerned with lots of issues right now. Politics remains a huge issue. People are talking about politics constantly, and what better way to spend your free time on earth than to argue about it on Facebook? We're in the state of perpetual war, and the military industrial complex is a problem, but at the same time, we love freedom, and so we're okay with that, and we think that's a big issue. Some people are really concerned with social and humanitarian issues, equal rights for men, women, male, female, whatever they consider themselves to be in between, and we're concerned about all of these things, and we think that on these things hinge our culture and our society and what's going to happen, but I don't think so. I was really excited when I got invited to come back and do this with you guys today, but I was even more excited when I found out what the topic was, because I believe that this topic, kind of science, is that on which everything about our culture and society actually hinges. And here is why. Here's why. All those things may be important. Politics, war, social issues, climate change, all that stuff people are concerned about. But the fundamental thing is who gets to tell the creation story for the next generation. And here's why. If you have a generation that grows up and sees the world around them and sees the universe around them and considers themselves to be an insignificant speck of dust in the infinite space of no meaning and no consequence at all, you're going to end up with a certain type of civilization in society. However, if you have a society that grows up and looks around them and sees that, yes, we are in a special place, chosen for us, made for us, and that this is actually the place that God made and chose, and he came and walked among us in flesh, and he was incarnate here, and you do have value, not because of what you do or how good you are, but because you're made in his image, and every human has that, you will have a very different kind of society for civilization. So this, that we're going to talk about for the next few minutes, is a really, really big deal. Okay? Hang with me today. We'll be through after this, but this is super important. Almost as important as you will do. Because I'm really getting on that too. So, here we go. Let's set the stage. So, for the last 400 or so years, science has kind of stepped in as a vehicle through which man decides to explain everything that he knows about him. And this empirical scientific method where we only believe what we can logically infer or understand from what we can see, measure, and duplicate or repeat scientifically. We're going to explain everything we can about the world around us here. Because we're tired. We are absolutely tired of you theologians, you higher thinking religious people telling us how many angels can dance on the head of 10. We want to see what we can figure out through our own senses. And for 400 years, let's be honest, the natural scientists, they've had a good run. We got cell phones out of it. They don't work here, but we have cell phones out of it, okay? People are flying through the air in gigantic metal cylindrical tubes all over the earth. We have the internet. We've killed off polio and other diseases and things like that. We actually have some things to show for this methodology. But I would ask you, what happens when we come to the end of this lecture in 2018, almost 2019, and the natural sciences have run up against a wall, and they circle all the way back around, almost to where we began, where they realize we have pulled absolutely everything we can out of our five senses, and this stuff still doesn't add up. But we absolutely refuse to go back to believing that there is a God. We will not admit that. We will do anything except admit that there is a God that we are accountable to. So what are we going to do? And you don't have to take my word for it today, because you know there is a technical difficulty, and it's going to stay in video. If you were done here, from the leading academic minds in the world today, to what they are saying. What they actually have to say might surprise you. But first, before we do that, I want to call your attention to a scripture besides this one. And we're not going to just say this scripture today, but it's a very, very good backdrop for what we're talking about. And it's Paul's visit to the Areopagus in Athens in Acts chapter 17. Okay? And here's what's interesting. When people talk about a secular world right now, you know, people don't believe that they have faith. People believe that we're just rational and we believe things because there's evidence for them. And then we look at Paul speaking to the Areopagus in Acts chapter 17 and say, what does that have to do with what we see today? You got it. But of course, this was written a really long time ago, and so Paul's talking to these little Greek guys and pilgrims, talking about properly, and anything to do with our world today. Okay, be honest. A lot of people feel that way. A lot of people feel that way. But when Paul talks to these guys in the Areopagus, he's talking to two different groups of people. He's talking to the leading thinkers of the day, who have ideas not too different from what the leading thinkers today actually have. He's talking to two groups of people. He's talking to a group of people called Philip, and Philip believes that George doesn't have any notion at all. You're just supposed to break through life, and at the end of life, you become part of the universe. And so there's no real reason to get worked up about anything. To be, you know, the very kind of guy tricking their smile. Be like that guy, right? So, the other Stoic, and before you say, nobody is Stoic today, have you ever heard someone say, I'm just trying not to get my feelings? Stoicism. The same thing. Or, I'm tired of letting my happiness depend on how other people treat me. I'm not even going to feel it anymore. I'm just going to be mean to people because they're all mean to me. You've got an annoying friend that does that like that. And then they go back to what they're doing. They're trying to be Stoic. It's the exact same thing that Paul was having. And then, alongside of the Stoics, there was a group of people called the Epicureans. And the Epicureans basically said, when you die, nothing happens. So while you're here, you might as well have as much fun as you can and try to stay away from as much pain as you can. So they essentially, back in, I don't know, 1680, were saying, no, well, they're leaving. That's new. It's not new. It's different. We're living in it now. But they're very Epicurean now. You're young. Just live life as much fun as you can. The point of life is to be happy. If it doesn't make you happy, you don't need it. Be happy. Get pleasure. Have fun. Do all these things. And try to stay away from anything that makes you uncomfortable and unhappy. Is that not familiar? Is that what a lot of people are today? And it's exactly what Paul was talking to back in Acts chapter 17. So before you look at the picture, you say, nothing to do with what I'm dealing with in my classes, nothing to do with what I'm dealing with these professors who don't believe in God, nothing to do with my dramatic friend who calls me every night and complains or texts me or FaceTime me about, they have everything to do with that. Okay? And here's why. Paul goes to the Areopagus and he says, I put you guys in very religious. Because while I was here hanging out, when I was dialoguing with all these people here in Athens, I noticed that you got thousands of idols for pretty much everything, and you got one that you can't quite put your finger on, but you know it's there, you know it's real, so you have an altar to the unknown God. And I know you're a religious people. And people say, well, okay, well, we're less religious now than we were then, and that's not really true. We might not want to attach ourselves to institutional religion. Oh, yes, 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 young people. The other friend says, I'm not religious. That's their altar to the unknown God, but they know there's more than just what they can see with their eyes to the soul. They know that there are real aspects you can't measure with science, but they don't want to go to church, right? They don't want institutional religion. They don't want what they consider to be hypocritical religion. So I'm serious about that, right? I'm one with you. I'm one with myself. Girl, find yourself. That's all they're trying to do. It's the same stuff, okay? You have friends that are here. Probably is busy. So, like, if you have a friend that just said that this morning, don't look at her because I'm going to know I'm going to call it out. I'm going to be cool with learning something like that. You know, that's probably not going to be good, okay? So, here's the thing. Paul talks to these folks and he says, you know, what if there's something that you are not aware of and I'm here to declare to you? And here's the central message in Acts chapter 17 is that everybody believes. Everybody is religious. Even if you say you're not religious, you are. And here's why. Because, one, even if you say I don't believe in God, I don't have faith. But there's something about that statement, you know, I have a professor or teacher that says that. I don't believe God exists. Can't you possibly prove that by the scientific methods that God does not exist? Maybe it's kind of vegetarian. He says, you know, when you die, you just die. So live the best life you can, live a legacy, live an impact, live for life of purpose, you know, do something positive that people are living for, but when you die, nothing happens. Can you prove that there is no afterlife there? No. So what does that mean? That means that even that worldview is a belief. You can't be proved. It's a philosophy. Everybody believes something. Everybody worships something. Now, here's the second thing. In our skeptical, secular culture, we also become very concerned with social and humanitarian issues, right? I was watching a magic show yesterday with my wife called Magic for Humans. Yeah, it's pretty cool. He's talking to grade school kids, and they're in there, and his whole illusionary trick is that he's predicting what they would choose their school uniform to be if they had a choice. So he pulled out a little diagram on an easel, and it's just like an average, like, six-figure guy with, you know, a uniform on. A little girl raises her hand, and she says, can we have equal rights and have a girl picture too?
And I was like, I was busy, and he said, hey, is there a girl version? Because I'm gonna wear a guy's coat.
But now we're thinking of everything in these social issues. Like, everyone is equal, we have to have equal rights, can't just pick a bit, we can't make anybody feel uncomfortable, unhappy, right? And we believe those things are true, right? We believe that there is wrong for people not to have equal rights, right? It's wrong. Right or wrong? That's the thing. DJ, I'm going to use you as an example, because you may sound so right now, and I don't know how to do it. But if you believe there is no God, that means there is no standard of morality in the world around you. And that means that you have absolutely no basis to say anything is right or wrong. Because when you say something is wrong, if something is right, you are appealing to a standard that is not in your own. Let me explain. If you truly believe, like most people who are secular, skeptics, or atheists do, that life is not special and it's happened by natural processes, and all of these things that we see around us are from natural selection, which is a process in nature by which weak things get killed and eaten by strong things, right? And that explains everything around us, then what you believe is that, yes, natural selection is real, the strong kill the weak, that's the circle of life, the single eye became strong, but when it comes to humans, we have to respect God. The modern atheist says that man descended from nature, therefore a new commandment I give you, let us love one another. Does that make any sense at all? Everything about their worldview explains that there is no such thing as right and wrong, and people and animals can do what they have to do to survive. They're strong, they're weak, that's how it happens. But we better count every single person as equal. There are no culturally superior worldviews. We have to respect everybody's worldview at the same level. You realize that if we believe that natural selection is the way this happens, there is no right and wrong, there is no morality. What you can say to someone, what did he do? I'm going to hit you in the face. Go do it. How do I get to see you?
One like
it. One like it. That makes you feel bad. I would feel very mad at you. You can say that. You can explain your personal feelings in morality, but what you can't say without appealing to a greater standard of morality outside of us is that it's actually wrong for me to do this. Therefore, you have to say to me, I don't know how that feels. That would make me feel very sad. I said, I would prefer that you didn't hit me in the face. And I would say, well, I prefer that I hit you in the face right now. And you're currently sitting, and I mean, I have leverage, and this is a strong deal. So, that's a selection. But there's nothing wrong about that by a naturalist worldview. But nobody actually believes that, now do they? The same teacher or professor that will tell you that natural selection is how we got here will tell you that if you punched your classmate in the face, it was wrong.
So what I was saying is that the silent clients in our world, before we actually know that we hear directly from them, is a situation where people think in one world, but they live in another. They say that there is really no purpose, there's no right and wrong, but when they go home and see their family at night, they believe very much that they actually love them. They say there is no right or wrong, they say there is no purpose, but you don't have the right to tell me that I'm inferior just because I'm a woman, or just because I'm a man, or just because I'm from this country. Well, is there right or wrong? Possibly tell us. You have absolutely no evidence from your basis of your worldview. You just kind of like the way it sounds. And you wonder why? Because it's an authenticity unknown God. There's something in humanity that comes built in that we just know these things. We know there's a right and wrong. We know that a tree that's killing an animal is different than a person killing a person. We know that murder is different from killing. We even make a distinguishing the difference between someone shooting a deer for sport or shooting a deer and then consuming that deer. Right? We know these things. We know that love is real. We know that there is more. And we know that when you die, that can't be all that matters. Nobody knows these things. Okay? So let's move forward just a little bit. These are philosophical questions. They are deeper. They are beliefs. All the things that we're concerned about, we can't even touch
without appealing to a worldview that would say everything makes no sense. Because we've been talking about kind of like the time and air stuff now. I'm going to talk about science and science, because I think, and I'm not even going to actually talk about the science. I'm going to let people who know the science and who are writing the science actually talk about the science. I know that what you guys are thinking is we're going to talk about evolution, we're talking about evolution, so I'm teaching evolution. But can we just put the nail on that one? Can we just say that one is done? Can we not just spend 30 minutes today explaining that they actually don't have any transitional forms of the same species? It's yin to an evolution debate with somebody or a teacher. This is mid, yes, I believe in microevolution. I believe that animals of the same species can have variation and change over time. I finally ended up with pit bulls and Rottweilers, Pomeranians, and whatever people put in the flavor. This stuff happens, it exists, but you can't tell me one fossil in the record where a dog has become a feline, that sort of thing doesn't exist, you don't have the evidence for it. Just put the nail on that, it's really not that hard. Evolution is really dead. They kind of know it's dead, so they have to back it up with a contingency, and the contingency for evolution is cosmology. So if we can prove that life evolved other places, then it makes sense that it evolved here, so we can plot out the history of the universe and the origins of the universe, and we'll be able to prove that there was no God who created it. So let's do it. Let's get to it. Here's what we're trying to do. Now, I'm not going to beat on that dead horse for the rest of the day, because this is actually worse than just evolutionary origin of life. When it comes to cosmology, does anyone know what cosmology is?
What cosmology? Studying where things come from.
Studying where things come from, particularly with reference to our universe, our galaxy, our local neighborhood in our solar system, all things that we see out in space, right? Because if we can't really explain how things started here, well, maybe if we can explain how things started everywhere, then what happens here might make sense. So that's what cosmology is. And I'm just going to let you know that 97% of it is missing. Look, I'm going to tell you that they have zero idea what is going on. And I'll show that to you by just showing some of the leading thinkers in the world. So this is what Lawrence Krauss, he's a professor at Arizona State University, studied in the PhD from all of the Ivy League schools. He's going to talk about cosmology for just a second. I'm going to pause him a couple of times because it's super, alright, you'll see what's going on. Here's one. Work with me, Lawrence. I know this isn't a fun day for you, but
I'm excited for cosmology because everything is changing. Wall Street was useful before we had natural science. You can speculate about the origin of the universe, but you can speculate so the cows come home. Between one and...
Now,
That's one of the crux of admitting that we speculate into a calcium home about the origin of the universe because they don't know. Now, he's about to talk about something that I'm going to make a lot of fun of in a few minutes, and you should too if you understand it, but this is how they get to where they are with the current cosmological model.
3% of the universe is all the stuff we can see, and you know, somewhere between 99% and 97% of the universe is stuff we can't see.
Wait a second. I thought we only do science based on things that we can see, measure, duplicate, and record. However, in the highest levels of cosmology, which is the science of explaining how all this came to be, 97% of it, we can't see. That's from his mouth, not mine. It gets worse. This is the beginning. I wouldn't say this. I wouldn't put this up.
This dark matter that dominates our galaxy, we think we're virtually certain now is made of some new type of elementary particle, different than the stuff that makes you and I have. It turns out the gravitational...
Okay, so we have 97% of the universe that is made up of something called dark matter.
Doesn't that sound like that with that movie?
Dark matter makes up 97% of the universe, and guess what? It's not the same kind of stuff that we can see, touch, taste, feel, measure, or even detect. At all. I'm going to explain why. Have you ever heard someone say the universe came from nothing? And you're like, how does that make sense? Nothing, something can't come from nothing. But then they redefine nothing as something. Well, when they say nothing, yeah, it's me, right? That's someone who just passed out like that. They don't really mean nothing. What they really mean is dark matter. This is what they're attributing to be nothing. Now, we're going to talk about some of this here.
Energy of every galaxy moving away from us to zero. And that strongly suggested that we actually, that the universe actually came from nothing.
Things are moving in the universe. That is strongly suggestive that we came from nothing. Okay, keep going.
That every measurement we can make about the universe is really consistent with the universe that came from nothing.
Well, it's a strange time in cosmology. It's an interesting time because we don't understand anything.
You're good. Come on, we can do this all day. He's not done. Here you go.
Or rather, we don't understand nothing. Because
okay, now we have bad grammar and bad science. I don't know what to do.
Turns out nothing is almost everything. Turns out the dominant stuff in the universe is nothing, and you don't have the slightest understanding of why.
Whoa! Because goodness. This is the guy that's sort of standing in an auditorium as a freshman at Arizona State University and telling you there is no God. We can prove it. Okay, well, what do you got? Well, I got 3% of the universe that I can account for. The other 97% is made of a substance called dark matter that we can't see, read, measure, or feel. And based on the way the planets are moving, we now know that the universe came from nothing, which is really not nothing, it's everything. But we can't say it's anything but nothing because it moves too fast for us to measure it or see it. But our equations don't work unless it's there. Perfect. It's really simple.
Nothing is really not quite nothing. Nothing is really a boiling, bubbling brew of crystal particles that pop in and out of existence at a time that's so short we can't actually see them. Now,
nothing is not actually nothing. It's a boiling brew of bubbling pot of
which is brew. Okay. You might say, because they exist at a time that's so short you can't even see them, it's like counting angels on the head of a pyramid.
Where have I heard that before? I digress.
It's like philosophy, it's not like physics.
It's philosophy, it's not physics. He's admitting this is not science.
But in fact, while we can't see those virtual particles directly, they do have an impact, an indirect impact, on atoms and the structure of atoms.
So, the thing that's controlling the universe, makes up most of the universe, holds the universe together, explains all of the physical things that we see. We can't measure and see, but we know it's there because of its impact on everything around it. Kind of sounds like somebody that I know who asked me to number this was if I could. But never mind that. Lawrence, I know what you're saying. Is it religious?
It's kind of cosmic natural selection. It's not fine-tuned. It's not religious.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Like some people think. It's the opposite. The reason the universe appears to be so tuned for our existence, it's not because some divine intelligence decided, I want to create a universe so people can be in it, but rather, if we're any different, you wouldn't be here. And there's no evidence of finding your purpose in the universe.
That's logical.
As far as we can tell. The two lessons of cosmology that I like to mention.
I want you guys to watch. This is the worldview that we talked about at the very beginning. Okay, this is the nihilistic, no purpose, no meaning, no right or wrong. This is the ultimate conclusion that a person will reach if they're honest about it. At least Lawrence is honest, because he's willing to say that.
We're more insignificant than we thought we were.
You are insignificant. You don't matter.
More, you're completely insignificant. All of our human drama and everything else is more relevant when it comes to the cosmos than it was before. So it's very significant, and the future is miserable. So those are the two things we learned.
You're insignificant, and the future is miserable. Look, look at your smile. Look how happy you are to see that. That's like Ted walking in with a belt. This is going to have people in the next day, and I'm like, I don't like the look on your face, Dad. I'm really sorry. The future is miserable. He looks really miserable delivering that. Right? It doesn't hate. That's Lawrence Krauss. And what I want to do is, I'll just and there are more. You ready? We're going to have too much fun. Do you guys know who Michio Kaku is? Michio Kaku is another leading anthropologist. He's from New York University, and he is catching some flack in Iowa today because those were the leading thinkers. He actually is a little bit more honest than most other folks in the field. And here's what he has to say about cosmology. He's just going to tell us.
What is a question in cosmology? Usually in science, if we're off by a factor of 2 or a factor of 10, we call that a problem. We say something's wrong with the theory. We're off by a factor of 10. However, in cosmology, we're off by a factor of 10 to the 120.
Great. Someone do that math for me. This is a good exponent. 10 to the 120.
Yeah, 120 zeros
after. Oh my goodness.
That is one with 120 zeros.
You are the greatest thinker of our time.
Yes.
I love that.
This is the largest mismatch between theory and experiment in the history of science.
Okay, Michio Kaku, leading astrophysicist, says that our factor being off 10 followed by 120 zeros is the greatest scientific mismatch between theory, or what we expect to see, or what we actually know to see ever in history. Who likes math? Are you cool with math? I don't like math. When I was a math teacher, I was destined to hate it. They used to wake me up in the morning, and I was in a lot of classes. When I was in training on that terminology, there's this thing called the unit circle. You remember the unit circle? She would walk in and quiz me on that thing with me. I'd be like, I don't know, but they go to sleep. That's why I was really happy when I got in the class. I was thinking, not breakfast today. I'm not going to worry about trigonometry. Anyway, what happens if you're off by 1 on a math test? The question right or wrong. Let me ask you, if you had 120 questions and you were off by 1, do you think there's something wrong with your method? Do you think you might want to re-examine your premises or your assumptions when it comes to your math test? Maybe there's something that I've overlooked. Maybe there's something that I'm missing. Let me just put this into perspective for you. 10 to 120 is actually a number that is so big that you can't write it out. It's so big that it would be more than the grains of the sand on the planet. And it's actually so big that there are more zeros in that number than there are atoms in the currently observed universe. That's how far off we are. That's what being off 97% actually means. Do you think you're talking about that in science class? No. Okay, so Mr. Johnson says that we're not being honest, and what should happen when your number is off by this far? And I would just say, listen to this comment, okay? If you have a theory of everything, and you're off by that much, if your best chance to explain the universe without God is off by that much, you're having a bad time. You're in big trouble. And you might want to rethink your situation. So, when your best two theories are off by a number that large, you might want to re-examine your approach. Now, here's the thing. You have to be saying, how do these guys, you know, fit in their academic chair and know that this is the stuff that we're pushing out and we're telling people is absolute fact and we've nailed it down and it's provable? How are they doing that with a clear conscience? Are they just evil? Do they just not care? Do they think that we're just too dumb when they admit it by their own words what is actually going on here? And I would actually put to you this one, that even though your high school or college professor might have to really believe that this is okay because their job is online and they could lose their job due to anything else. So the people at the very highest levels of academia right now, like these guys or instructions that you're talking to, which is also with different women second, guys like the best types of these knowledge delivery, all these guys, they know they're at the end of the road. This should actually be encouraging because they know. And the stuff that they start to say starts to feel eerily similar to stuff that you've been saying all along, that you just say from a different direction with a different attitude and a different level of reverence. They go back even further. Since they're trying to invoke the magic of billions of years, and their multiverse, their billions of universes, which are also invisible and unmeasurable, they are creating philosophy, not science, and they're right back where they started. Most highly technology even admit that there was probably some sort of intelligent design in the process of origin. But a very peculiar kind, and I want you to look. Has anyone ever seen the movie Expelled from the Senate Time? Have you guys seen it? Or highly recommend it. I want to show you an interview between Richard Dawkins and Ben Stein. Richard Dawkins is one of the leading vocal, militant, angry atheists who decry religion and God at every possible opportunity. This is some questions that Ben Stein asked him in the
book. Well, then, here's your choice, Alan Zemiris. Why don't you forget who? You immediately beg the question, why do you think about who? By the hand of the creator. Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how that started. You know the kind of event that must have been. You know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right, how did that happen?
I told you, I don't know.
Excuse me? How about this with science? How about when we believe the things that we could prove and that we could know to definitely be sure? All right.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, 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 no,
nobody knows how it started, not just me.
What do you think is the possibility that the intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way.
Hold just a doggone minute. Didn't we just hear a guy in his camp say that so far as we can tell, there's no evidence for intelligent design in any of us? So now we have maps that don't add up, theories that don't add up, and now we have conflicts within our own little tribe of atheism. Does it sound like cosmology is on shaky ground? It is. It definitely is. We continue.
It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means, a very, very high level of technology, and designed the form of life that they seeded onto, perhaps, this planet.
Look at the really good question. So, somewhere else in the universe, life could have evolved, and then they came and seeded life here. But that's just pushing the argument down another level, right? Where did they come from? We don't want to talk about that.
Now, that is a possibility, and an intriguing possibility. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of our chemistry and molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Where is it?
So if you don't just look at the universe, if you look at molecular biology, if you look at genetics, you might actually see that there's a clear signature that somebody put this together on purpose. That's the leading opponent to the God of the Bible right now in the world today. Ben Stein asked a very logical question.
Okay. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence. And elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable, or ultimately explicable.
If we can't explain it, I reject it.
Okay. We couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously.
Wait, I thought that's what we just said that the universe did. It jumped into existence spontaneously. I thought that we said that 97% of the universe is made of dark matter that does what? Jumps into existence and back out so fast that we can't see it or measure it. But, okay.
The point.
So, Professor Dawkins is not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God.
Hold that thought, because that is exactly what we're coming to, okay? I'm just going to leave this here. We're almost done. One more person that we want to reference. But if you can take anything from Richard Dawkins, it is this. Yes, I guess intelligent design might make more sense than what we see. Two, there's definitely a signature
molecular biology. Information doesn't organize itself out of chaos, right? Information has to be organized by an intelligence, okay? And he believes that there's probably an intelligence that could do it, but it has to be one that isn't the God of the Bible. Why? You can look up any number of the church about the Lord speaking, and exactly why. He thinks he needs the God of the Bible so much. Because it has to arrive by some other evolutionary process, and here's why he believes that. If it arises by evolution, naturally it should be somewhere else. It means that it's nothing different from us, it means we're on the same plane, and it means that we're not accountable to it. And that's where the big thing happens. If it's God, it has dominion over me, and I'm accountable to him because he made me. If it's just another form of life that arose somewhere in the super advanced, well, then we just play down the path that we were. We don't owe them anything. They don't have to answer to them. Richard Dawkins doesn't reject the Creator because he rejects scientifically or proves that there is no possibility of a Creator. He rejects a specific type of Creator because he doesn't like what that would mean to his own personal life choices. And that's a totally different wormhole altogether. However, he's not the only one. I just want you to recall another time in Genesis where someone said to mankind, and ye shall be as God. And we've been saying it to ourselves ever since. And so we reject any possibility that would take away that idea. That we get to define our own morality. That we get to decide what is right and wrong. That we get to decide what is best for us. That we have to answer to somebody for how we conduct our stay here on earth. We'll choose anything but that. Anyone know who the other guy is? You ever seen him around? He does the show Cosmos now, he's an astrophysicist. He's kind of funny. He has up the hair like the Nutty Professor. If you don't know who the Nutty Professor is, well, then I'm old and I'll admit it, it's okay. But I want you to see where we're going with this now. We've got dark matter, we've got infinite universes, and we're still struggling with the idea that we are conscious and can know these things and that we're self-aware. How does this happen?
We're struggling
with free will. Here's what Neil
deGrasse
Tyson says about it.
Like Mr. Musk thinks, are we?
By the way, he is the highest paid astrophysicist personality now, okay? So this is his idea. Here we go.
Prism and simulation. I find it hard to argue against that possibility. Meaning, you look at our computing power today. And you say, I have the power to program a world inside of a computer. Well, imagine in the future where you have even more power than that, and you can create characters that have, for example, free will, or their own perception of free will. So this is a world, and I program in the laws that govern that world. That world will have its own laws of physics, and chemistry, and biology. Now, you're a character in that world, and you think you have free will, and you say, I want to invent a computer. So you do. Hey, I want to create a world in my computer. And then that world creates a world in its computer. And then you have simulations all the way down. So now you lay out all these universes and throw a dart. Which of these universes are you most likely to hit? The original one that started it? Or the countless simulations, the daughter simulations that unfolded thereafter? You're going to hit one of the simulations. So,
okay. Now hang with me here. This is his interpretation of a multiverse. All right? So, it's possible, since we know that we can create virtual worlds now, and very, very deep realistic worlds, characters inside those worlds would never know that they're in a simulation, but if you had more power, like our computers continue to increase in power, so if you had more knowledge and more resources, you could conceivably create a world that would have its own physics and biology and rules, and you'd be the set of parameters for those rules. You know, like the laws of nature and laws of thought and logic and things like that that everyone abides by. You could set all those rules and you could create people in that world that would have free will with those parameters that you design. And they're going to do what most creations do. They're going to imitate their creator, and at some point they're going to decide, we're going to design a world too. That's what he said. And that we're most likely just in a world that a higher intelligence created and defined the parameters for. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? Okay, here we go.
So, statistically, based on that argument, which first appeared by a philosopher from Oxford named Nick Bostrom back in the 1990s, that when computers were coming, real enough to think this through. It's hard to argue against the possibility that all of us are not just the creation of some kid in a parent's basement.
I want you to hold on to that. I want you to check his tone. I want you to check how he feels about that creator when he makes that statement. Okay?
Programming up a world for your own entertainment. And then every time something weird happens in the world, some disruptive leader takes charge, and I wonder if that programmer just got bored and had to stir the pot. They throw somebody in there just for their own entertainment. For me, that's some of the best that we live in a simulation. Because this happens every time there's peace and tranquility in the world.
Well, this is true. What can we do about it? It's like the Truman Movie.
Yeah, well, he can try to escape by going in the Truman Movie to go through the barrier.
Yeah.
But, yeah, if you're programmed by somebody, yeah, no. There's nothing you can do.
What difference does it make if I'm programmed by someone?
I guess I
don't know it.
I guess it doesn't make any difference at all.
That's Neil deGrasse Tyson, the leading astrophysicist in our world right now. The highest paid personality to speak for such things. I just want to break down what he just said, and I want to show you the difference. He just said, it's very hard for him to argue against the reality that we're probably living in a program universe or world that is created by a higher intelligence who set the parameters for things like physics, biochemistry, gave the people inhabiting the world free will. I just want to ask you guys a question. If the world really sounds so different from what God has done anyway, isn't that the same thing? We had a higher intelligence who created the world and then put people in it that had free will and governed the laws of physics that we experience every day that we discover. Doesn't that sound like God to you? And furthermore, he goes on to say that every so often when something strange happens, that this programmer drops the person into history just to stir things up for either his own entertainment or some other purpose that we're unaware of. And to me, if I'm just thinking about this, it sounds an awful lot like when God would say things like, I am raising up the Chaldeans. I am raising up Nebuchadnezzar by my own hand. I have raised up Pharaoh to show my glory in the land. Nebuchadnezzar is my tool. I will show him that it's not by his glory that he achieved these things, but he's done it because of the power that I gave him. I read things in Deuteronomy like God, and Genesis like God, defining the borders of nations ahead of time and dictating how long that they're going to be in power. I read things about God's sovereignty and how he deals with people individually and as a people group. And I know these things from Scripture and these things that God has told me that he has been doing from the beginning, and then I listen to him to that Tyson say, I find it very hard to argue against the possibility that there would be a higher intelligence that would do these same things, and we're just living in that. But that sounds weird to you guys. What do you think about that? But the same guy who would say there's absolutely no God that has forced you to believe in one, would end up coming all the way back around to say that the living universe is the exact same as the one that we said we live in, without God. There's one difference. Two differences. It's found in Acts chapter 17, where it's found in Romans chapter 1, all the way in. And it's found in the statement by Neil deGrasse Tyson where he says, some kid in a parent's basement. For his own enjoyment. Those statements are not ones of reverence. They're not statements of respect when the higher intelligence that has programmed him, brought him into existence, gave him free will, allowed him to explore and learn and understand and be self-aware, but they are a tone of resentment and anger. And that is the only difference in what you can see in that area and what you can see in that area. It's that he doesn't reject the possibility of God. When he looks at God, he doesn't see a loving, creative God. He sees some kind of parent's basement. He's doing things willingly for his free will. And I have no reverence for that. In essence, you know what that Tyson says, that's some kid in the parent's basement
Because in the end, they've got to have more faith in you than you have to.